appreciate y'all being here tonight. Thank y'all for coming back. Some of you that were visiting last night, we got some new ones tonight. Brother Medlock, thanks for being here. And thank you, Brother Harris, for that beautiful prayer, man. Appreciate you. And you guys being here tonight from different congregations, and especially the Dawson Road congregation, they've been so kind to us. And Kay and I love being here. We love this congregation. We love Farron and Terry. And we just appreciate y'all so much, and we just continue to pray for the good work here at Dawson Road. Kay and I will head home in the morning to Atlanta and get to work back there. And you pray for us, and we'll continue to pray for you, and we're just grateful. I tell you what, if anything, I have so much fun here, but I eat so much when I come here. And they pick you up, and they take you to lunch, and they feed you, and then they feed you at late at night. And then, well, I found out today that's how they pay preachers that come, and that's about it, groceries. And but I appreciate it, Terry. And Terry made me pecan pie tonight, and that was good enough, and it was awesome. So, and Eddie, thanks for coming back. Man, you guys, I appreciate you. And so much. I'm going to be in the book of Daniel tonight for just a few minutes, and I'm going to talk about exactly what we've been singing about, the one that holds the future. I'm going to put this away, where I can kind of move around a little bit. I love that Gaither song. I love the words of that song. Because he lives, I can face tomorrow. Because he lives, all fear is gone. Because I know he holds the future and life is worth the living, just because I know he lives. Knowing the future is big business. It really is. I read not long ago that in the United States, it is a $2 billion a year industry. Do you know that? Horoscopes, things like that, palm reading, it is amazing how much money is spent, fortune cookies. You put it all together. In the United States, $2 billion, with a B, is spent. Strangely, in the same article, it said that in Italy, it is a $6 billion a year industry. Very strange thing. And according to Atlantic Magazine, I thought this was interesting. It quotes, and I'm quoting them, "Millennials have taken astrology and run with it. They feel that they are the most stressed out generation of all. And so they're looking to astrology to cope." That's the millennial generation. Even among religious people today, if you want a book that sells, write it on prophecy. Have a prophecy seminar, because people want to know what's going to happen in the future. I read a quote by a psychologist, and I thought, when you think, why all this interest? Why is it that people want to know about the future? And I thought this was just a very simplistic quote, but I thought this explains it so well. He said, and I quote, "One of the most powerful influences on fear is uncertainty." That's true, isn't it? Is that if you're uncertain about the future, then you're afraid of it. The less we know, the more threatened we feel, because of the lack of knowledge means we don't know what we need to know to protect ourselves. And so he uses an illustration, this psychologist. And he says, say you're in a car driving down the highway at 85 miles an hour. Forget about, the speed limits right now. But you're going 85 miles an hour, and you're driving down the road, and you close your eyes. That's fear. You're not going to last very long with your eyes closed. And it's because all of us have a survival instinct in us. We want to survive. So when we drive our cars, we want to see as far down the road as we possibly can. We want to see. If it's at night, we want to drive with our high beams on, or however best we can, even if we could see around a corner. We want to see around the corner because we want to know what's coming. And I think that's the heart of why people are so interested in the future. They want to know what's coming. And if they know what's coming, then they're better to deal with it. And I'll ask this question, do you really want to know your future? And the answer probably is no. And the reason I say that is because if you knew everything that was going to happen to you and your loved ones, that you knew that they were going to die at a certain time or at a certain moment or a certain way, you had no idea, and then all of a sudden you knew all of this, it would overwhelm you. It would be too much for us frail creatures that God made to be able to assess all that information we don't need. It would overwhelm us to know the future. Well, in Daniel chapter 2, I chose this text because a king by the name of Nebuchadnezzar wants to know the future. He is thinking about the future. He is dwelling on the future. He's thinking about his future, the future of the kingdom. That's the setting of this. And he falls asleep and he has a dream. And in that dream, actually he has a series of dreams. And in this series of dreams, he sees something that alarms him, but he doesn't understand it. And so he calls everyone in. Nebuchadnezzar is the most powerful man in human alive during this time. He is the ruler. He is the king of kings, if you will, of humans. Of everyone living, Nebuchadnezzar would be the man. In fact, even Daniel says that to him. If you know the story of Daniel chapter 2, in the interpretation of the dream, he is the head of the statue made of gold, and he has all things. And he says, God has made you ruler. He's given you things. In fact, he says, hey, he puts kings in and he takes them out. And I think he still does today. And so God is sovereign. He's involved in what's happening in our world. Sometimes we wring our hands and we watch the news and so forth. And we ought to pray about it. We ought to be concerned about it. But folks, God, he's in control. He is sovereign. And he is working all things out. And I want to speak to that tonight in somewhat of a general way as I talk about the future. So the king has this dream or a series of dreams. He calls in his, if you will, the elite of the occult. He has on his staff people that are supposed to be able to interpret these kinds of things, dreams and visions. And there are sorcerers and conjurers and the Chaldeans and so forth. He calls them all in. And he says, here, I want you guys to tell me the dream. And if you don't know this story, what's interesting is twice they say to him, hey, king, we're willing to do it. You tell us the dream and we'll give you the interpretation. You remember what Nebuchadnezzar does to him, don't you? He says, no. You tell me the dream and then you tell me the interpretation. That's pretty tough, isn't it? Now, I don't want to get too much ahead of myself, but I want to get what's so wonderful is when God reveals this dream, as you know the story, to Daniel. What I love about this is God tells Daniel even what Nebuchadnezzar was thinking before he fell asleep. That's how involved God is in the lives of people. He could go back and tell exactly what Nebuchadnezzar was even thinking about before he fell asleep and had this dream that, by the way, God revealed it to him. And so he would want to know this information. And so so he calls everybody in. He says, listen, we're gonna find out what this means. So this is Daniel chapter 2. It's obviously a lengthy chapter. For the sake of time, I'm not going to read it all, but I'll set it up for you in what I've already said. Chapter 2 of Daniel, verse 1 and following. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, plural, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. And the king gave orders to call the magicians and the conjurers and the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, and to tell the king his dreams. And so they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit was anxious to understand the dream. Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic and said, O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants, and we'll declare the interpretation. The king replied to them, the command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you'll be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. That's a big incentive, isn't it? And if you declare the dream, its interpretation, you'll receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and the interpretation. A second time they say to him, hey, listen, we're willing to do it. Just tell us the dream. The king said, I know for certain that you're bargaining for time, inasmuch, this is verse 8, inasmuch as seeing the command from me is firm, that if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you, for you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, that I may know that you declare it to me, its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered and said to the king, and listen, if y'all believe in writing in your Bible or underlining in your Bible, you ought to underline this verse. No pure words have ever been spoken by people. By the way, I see some people underlining a Bible that was taken out of the pew. Don't do that. No, I'm just kidding. your highlight and your songbook. Don't do that. No truer words have ever been spoken than these words in verse 10. There is not a man on earth who declared the matter for the king, and as much no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there is no one else who could declare to the king except God's, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. Because of this, the king became indignant and furious and gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon, and the decree went forth. Here's number one, and that is the future is unknown to us. No man can know the future. Man, no pure words, nobody, no human will ever know the future. Can you imagine even some of the best guessers, you know, these guys that watch sports all the time think they know what's going to happen? You think when they were watching the horse race this past Sunday, the Kentucky Derby, you would have ever thought that never in a Kentucky Derby race has there ever been a situation like there was this past weekend? You know what I'm talking about? Horses stumbling into each other, crossing over lanes. The horse that was in the lead and that was supposed to win the race was disqualified. There is no way that a man could know that. Now, keep that, by the way, in your mind. But even specific things or even general things, there is no way that a man could know these things. In fact, what he says, what the people say to Nebuchadnezzar, is this is too difficult and this has never been asked by any king or ruler. In other words, you shouldn't even be asking. This doesn't even fall under our job description. But folks, that's why they're on the books. That's why they were hired in the first place, because their claim was that they knew these kinds of things. Now, what they were going to say is they needed a dream in order to get an interpretation. And he said, well, we're going to see if you're the real thing. I want the dream and the interpretation. And they said, no man can reveal this. Now, I'm going to just kind of stop here for a minute and say this was a dream that was meant to be interpreted. And we know that because the interpretation of this dream is a very vast thing that's going to be talking about empires to come, kings that would lead, generations that would come and go. It's an incredible thing. And it's a reminder that, as we're going to see tonight, that even though Nebuchadnezzar nor these conjurers, by the way, not even Daniel can know what's coming, but God does. He knows what's coming. And so no man can know. I thought this was interesting. I just kind of a fact, I thought it was interesting. All of us dream. Did you know that? Everybody has a dream. I dreamt last night that I was supposed to go into the major leagues, and I was trying to make it. Why is that funny to y'all? So I was telling Kay this dream this morning, and I think it was because I read some stuff by Tim Tebow and before he went to start playing baseball, and I dreamt that I was in the ocean, and when I came out of the ocean, there was a baseball under my arm, and it was like an indication that I should go. And I think the combination of this sermon and something that I ate here made by Ida last night made me have that dream. Scientists and doctors tell us that all of us dream. You may not remember your dream, but you dream. Sometimes you remember, but 90 minutes into your sleep cycle, you begin to dream. And every 90 minutes, the way you were made, the way God made you, your brain fires off every 90 minutes into another dream cycle and has to do, you know, kind of the things you've been reading or thinking about, maybe your subconscious and all these kind of things. But all of us dream. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, but it's not just a weird dream with a baseball under his arm. He's having a dream that literally would be interpreted of generations to come. So, again, just in case he is not getting his message across to the guys on his payroll, these guys that traffic in dreams, he's gonna kill them all if they don't come up with the interpretation. Now, I give you some verses. This is Ecclesiastes. I like what Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 7, verse 14. He says, when times are good, be happy, but when times are bad, consider this. God has made the one as well as the other, therefore no one can discover anything about their future. In the United States, 125 million people believe in astrology. And 7% say that they actually alter their lives during the week because of reading their horoscope. And you're saying, hey, what's the big deal? That's 12 million people. 12 million people say they alter their lives because of a horoscope. The Gallup organization said people, at least 10% of the people who claim to be Christians, believe in astrology. And so you kind of have this dynamic going on where we say, well, you know, I just don't know if I want to believe in that. I want to come back to what this man said to Nebuchadnezzar. No man, not any man, can know the future. The second thing is, though the future is unknown by man, it is well known by God. That is the second principle, very quickly, that we're going to look at in this story. Verse 15, so the king says, all right, we're gonna destroy all of you. Guess who's part of that group? Daniel and three guys that you would know as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they're a part of the group that's going to die. And so Arok, this is the king's right-hand man, Arok is going to go out. He's in charge of the destruction. So Arok is going to go out, he's going to find these guys, track them down, and kill them. And so word gets to Daniel, and Daniel says, hey, wait a minute, what's going on? And they explain to him what's happened. And apparently Daniel wasn't one of the people who were called in. And he said, give me a little bit of time. You just give me a little bit of time, and I'm gonna help this situation. And you know what he does, and you keep reading the text here, verse 15 and following. He gets together with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, real names, Hananias, Mishael, and Azariah. He gets together with them, and he asks them to what? To pray. He says, hey, pray for me. Pray for this situation. Pray for all of us in this situation. So the delay is so that they could pray. They were going to ask God for help in discerning what this dream was. Now, Daniel, according to verse 19, the Bible says the secret has been revealed to Daniel in a night vision. There's a difference between a dream and a vision. You're asleep when you have a dream, and you're awake when you have a vision. And so Daniel gets a vision, and it's revealed to him. Daniel is so happy, so Daniel blesses the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of the God forever for his wisdom, his might. He changes the times and the season. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in darkness, and light dwells in him. I thank you and praise you, God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might. You have made known to me what we have asked of you, and you have made known to us the king's demand. God can do that. This is something that Daniel knew that that these men did not know, that God could do what man could not do, that he could reveal this information to them. In fact, in Psalm 139, David says this, Lord, you've searched me and you've known me. You've known my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thoughts far off. You comprehend my path, my lying down. You're acquainted with all of my ways. There is not a word on my tongue, but behold, Lord, you know it altogether. Can you imagine that even before we speak a word, God knows what we're going to say? God has all knowledge. He is omniscient, is what we say about that. It's kind of a fancy word to say that God knows everything. You can't tell God anything he doesn't know. God never says, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't see that coming. Of course he saw it coming. He saw it in the past. He sees it now, and he sees it in the future. He is not confined by time. He's not limited to the things that we're limited to. And so to God, his recall is, it's immediate. It's comprehensive. It's without deterioration. Somebody asked me tonight, hey, what'd you preach on last night? Well, I remember the topic, but, you know, there are a lot of details that I've forgotten since then, you know. And that's not what God would remember every detail. He would know it. He wouldn't have to be reminded of it. He wouldn't have to look at notes to rehearse it. He knows everything. He doesn't have to be informed. And I don't get, I'm not beating a dog here and saying it over and over for no reason at all. I want you to just allow that to sink in, because there's great power in knowing that. There's great confidence in knowing that. In fact, this is exactly what Daniel is banking on. Daniel knows that God has this attribute. Of all attributes, and he has so many, Daniel activates his faith in God because the God he knows all. Someone once said that faith is putting your eggs in God's basket and counting them before they hatch. I like that. The third thing I want to tell you is the future is made known to us like it was made known to Daniel. In other words, God reveals the future to us. Now, he doesn't give us a vision. He's not going to give us a dream. But guess how God has revealed the future to us? In this book right here. Did you know that this book, the Bible, is actually 1/4 prophecy? Now, I'm going to say it again. That is a lot. If you take this book, it is 1/4 prophecy. That what I'm saying is, there were things from the very beginning of this book, even toward the end of this book, that were predicted. They were prophetic things that were said, things that were going to happen. And 1/4 of this book are found in these things. Even in this midst of Daniel, remember, Daniel has been taken away. He's in captivity. Well, God said a long time ago before this that you're going to be taken into captivity. It's going to last 70 years. And after 70 years, you're going to go back home. Guess what? That's exactly what happened. Almost to the date, after 70 years, they would find their way back home. God said it was going to happen, and it happened exactly the way God said it was going to happen. He announced the coming Messiah. And I'm going to do just a little bit of this for what little time I have, but he announced the coming Messiah, the great deliverer. Jesus was going to come. There are prophecies about his birth, his life, his death, and his resurrection. There are things in the Bible about the future judgment, the new heaven, and the Bible talks about the new earth. And this is incredible when you think about names that have been named hundreds of years before they were even born. Their names are in the Bible. Did you know that? Somebody's name is in the Bible 330 years before they were even born. What are the chances of that? Now, you add detail upon detail, and it complicates the situation. There are people that do this for a living, and they call it compound probability. In other words, the more precise and the more detailed you get about a coming event, the more the probability is, the greater it becomes, the more details that you pile on it. So I want to give you, now there's over 300 in the Bible, at least over 300, 330, okay? I'm not going to give you 330. But real quick, I want to give you just a few, all right? And from these few, I'm going to make this point, and then we'll move on, all right? You don't need to write these down, but I want to give them to you. Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14, the Bible predicted that Jesus would be born a virgin, narrows down the population. He would be born in Bethlehem, Micah 5 and verse 2, predicted he would be born in the tribe of Judah. Just think of the chances of that. Genesis chapter 49, verse 10, that his ministry would begin in Jerusalem, not in Jerusalem, but in Galilee. That's Isaiah chapter 9 in verse 1. It was predicted that he would work miracles, Isaiah 35, 5 and 6. It was predicted that one day he would enter Jerusalem on a donkey, Zechariah 9 in verse 9. He would be betrayed by a friend, Psalm 41, verse 9. He would be sold out for 30 pieces of silver, Zechariah 11. In 12, he would be wounded and bruised, Isaiah 53, verse 5. His hands and feet would be pierced, Psalm 22, and verse 16. He would be crucified with thieves, Isaiah 53, 12. His garments would be torn and lots would be cast for them, Psalm 22, verse 18. His bones would not be broken, Psalm 34, and verse 20. His side would be pierced, Zechariah chapter 12, and verse 10. That he would be buried in a rich man's tomb, Isaiah 53 and verse 9, and that he would be raised from the dead, Psalm 16, verse 10. Now, y'all did a good job listening. And I know that seemed long, but that's only 16. Now, these guys that do compound probability say that it would take 300 billion years for us to do this over and over and over in order for just these 16 to happen. 300 billion years it would take doing these things, chancing these things over and over just for these 16 things to happen. Daniel said, I can't do it. They can't do it. But there is a God in heaven who knows these things, and he'll reveal these secrets. And the only explanation is divine authorship. The only explanation is that God knew all this. He designed all this, and he said all this. And its precision is undeniable. Just these 16, the future is well known by God. And I have to move on from that point, even though I like talking about those kinds of things. And then finally, knowing the future makes God known to us. Knowing the future makes God known to us. In other words, the future, prophecy, these things, they're God's calling card. This is what he uses to reveal himself to us, something about himself and the power of our God. Not only is he a loving God, not only is he a compassionate God, not only is he a forgiving God, as we studied about the other night, we talked about the book of Jonah, but he is a God who knows the future, and he knows these things are coming. And by revealing these things to us, it allows us to know something about God. This is verse 45, chapter 2 again. Inasmuch as you saw the stone was cut out of the mountain with hands, that you broke in the piece of iron and the bronze, clay, the silver and gold, these are all kingdoms that would come after Nebuchadnezzar. He says these are the things that are going to follow after you. The great God has made them known to the king that will pass what will pass after this. I love it. He calls him the great God. I love that. Verse 46, Nebuchadnezzar does what I think anybody ought to do when they're given this information. Do you see what he said does? He falls down on his face. This is a guy that is ruling the entire world. Nobody talks to him without permission, or they would die. He's about ready to kill hundreds, if not thousands, of people by a wave of a hand. And he falls down on his face. Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face before Daniel and commanded they should present offerings and incense. And the king answered Daniel and said, truly, your God is the God of God, the Lord of kings, the revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this matter. I love in Isaiah 41, God's speaking, and he says, hey, you present your case, set forth your arguments, bring your idols, you have them to tell us what's going to happen, to declare the things to come, to tell us what the future holds, so that we may know that they are gods. He's saying, let's see if they're going to predict the future. And he says, there's no way an idol is going to do that. Jesus saw prophecy basically as the same thing, that calling card. John chapter 14, verse 29, Jesus said, and now I have told you before it comes to pass, so that when it comes to pass, you may believe. It is the idea that when you see these things and you know these things, they will cause you to believe these things. Really the heart, if you know, it was the heart of the Gospel of John. Paul stood on the Areopagus in the book of Acts on Mars Hill, and he confronted the philosophers of Athens, and he said, listen, I know you guys are religious people because there's a lot of gods around here, but I want to tell you about the true God. I want to tell you about a God that loves you. And it's that Paul said, him I proclaim to you, the God that you don't know is the God that you should know, and he wants to know you. I love that. As he preached the gospel on Mars Hill, he came back to this one fact that I'm teaching tonight. Verse 45, Daniel says, the dream is certain and the interpretation is sure. You can count on it because he said it. Y'all, we don't know what's ahead of us. We can't see around the curves. You know, some of you, I know you're struggling right now, maybe with your health or a situation, a job situation, or maybe a relationship situation. I don't know. I know everywhere I go in my own congregation, my own family, everybody struggles to some degree. And there's fear, and there's the fear of the unknown. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I don't know what's going to happen next week and the next week and the next week. I want to remind you that God does, that he does know. He does know what's going to happen. And He'll give us the grace not only to endure today, but whatever's coming, He's going to give us the grace and the strength and the power to take care of whatever we need to take care of. Listen, our knowledge is limited. His is not. Our power is limited. His is not. And so our best days, regardless of what's going on in our life as Christians, our best days, they're ahead of us. It's trusting Him that makes the most sense. There was a woman named Corrie ten Boom. You probably read about her, heard about her over your lifetime, but she helped hide the Jews during World War II. They were being exterminated. They were being killed, and they arrested her, and they imprisoned her, and she was nearly killed. Some of her family were killed. What she endured, I can only imagine. And I've read some books about her, and man, you just talk about someone that could not have imagined what was going to happen to her family and her life. And this is what she said, and I quote, one of my favorite quotes of hers: "Never be afraid to entrust an unknown future into the hands of a known God." I love that. It sums it all up. Never be afraid to trust an unknown future into the hands of a known God. There was a couple called the Myros who many years ago were hiking along a lake, and they were with another couple. And the man was frail, and he had been sick, diagnosed with a rare form of cancer a year before. And it was all he could do to make it up this hill. And his wife said, "You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go up to that lodge," and she pointed to a beautiful lodge that was sitting near that lake. She said, "I'm going to go up to that lodge. I'm going to make some reservations for us. We're going to come back here. We're going to stay in that lodge next year." And she says, "You guys stay here. It's not that far away. I'm going to make reservations for us." She took off the path, and her husband sat down on a rock by that lake and started to cry. And the people that were with them said, what's wrong? And he said, "I don't know if I'm going to be around next year." He said, "She's going up to make reservations for something I may not be able to attend." And he looked around and he said, "I wish that my life was as stable as this lake, as this mountain, as these rocks." Little did he know that when Mount St. Helens erupted, that Spirit Lake and Harmony Lodge were blown from the face of the earth. What he thought was so solid and so lasting didn't exist after that. It took about 3 minutes to make it all disappear. What he thought had longevity had only seconds. Y'all, we trust God because our best days are ahead of us with Him. He has only our best in interest. Even with the things that come to us and we have no way of knowing what's going to come to us, we know He's going to help us. He loves us. He wants the very best for us. Listen, our love, you love your kids, don't you? Man, we love our kids. We love our grandkids. There's always this Papa Bear inside of me, you know. And I don't care how old you get, I'd like to tell you it goes away, but it does not. A couple of years ago, our son was in college. He was playing college ball. And they were playing a team that was like number one in the state of Georgia. And the other team was supposed to just beat his college team. But instead, their little team from Shorter College beat this big Division I school. And those fans were mad. Whatever it was that happened on that court, they were mad. Their parents were mad. They had people coming out of the stands that were coming down onto the court. First, they were going to whip our coach, and they were going to whip our players, but there was going to be a fight. And I don't know, y'all, how I did it, but I was way up in the stands, and the next thing I knew, I was standing by my son on the court. And he looked at me and said, "Dad, there's going to be a fight." And I said, "I know. That's why I'm here." He said, "Well, you better get behind me." And y'all, I realized how big those guys were coming toward us, and I got behind them. I thought, you know, my son's 6'5", and he's pretty good athlete, and he's taking care of himself. And fortunately, there wasn't any fighting. They all broke it up, and everybody went home, acted silly for a few minutes. This doesn't ever go away. Folks, God's love for you pales in comparison for your love for your child and grandchildren. You say, I don't know how I could love somebody so much. I'm telling you, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that he loves you so much that he would give his son to die for you and for me at the cross at Calvary. He loves us that much. It's love, I think, that motivates people after a while. Isn't that right? Fear doesn't motivate after a while. My dad motivated me by fear, you know. And then I got big. And I'd come home. Now I go home. My mom's 85 years old. She can hardly reach up into a cabinet. She says, Harold, will you get something down for me? She doesn't have to threaten me to beat me. And I'm going to go help her. I'm going to get something down out of that cabinet. You know why? Because I love my mama. And if she asks me to do something, I'm going to get it and take care of it. I was telling somebody last night that, you know, your mom's love for you, even as a little kid, doesn't go away. When I was a police officer in the city of West Palm, I was about 22 years old, and I was in full uniform, had my police car out with blue lights on. I was directing traffic in one of the busiest intersections in West Palm Beach. And my mom was on the way to the mall, and she stopped her car in the middle of the road, rolled down her window, and told me to get out of the road before I hurt myself. And I said, if you don't move your car out of this road, I'm going to shoot your tires out. And she got mad at me, wouldn't talk to me for a week. And drove off to the mall. You know what she saw? She saw her son out in the middle of the road, and her love for him and her concern for him, it pales in comparison to God's love and concern for you. Y'all, we live in a fallen world, in a sin-sick world. And a lot of times the things that come to us, it comes to us because maybe some of the poor choices we've made, some because of accident, some because of the randomness of sin. God didn't do this to you, but he is going to help you. Whatever is happening in your life, he is going to help you. He's going to give you the grace to get through today and tomorrow and the next day and the next day. And guess what? He can see it. He already knows the future. That's who I want to give my life to. That's who I want to entrust my life too. We're going to sing a song in just a minute. You know the song, Just As I Am Will Come Without One Plea. I love this song because that's how God wants us, just like we are, all of our warts and heartache. He knows what's best for us. He's already made a way where there was no way, that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, willing to confess him, willing to repent, just simply to turn away from that sin, and to confess that he is the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings, and that you'd be willing to submit to the death, burial, and the resurrection of Jesus, to be baptized into Christ and raised to walk, as Romans 6 says, into a brand new life. And folks, our best days are ahead of us. We have a man in our congregation who was sick, and he was, you know, getting frail, And he told me one time, he said, Harold, I just can't wait to get to heaven. I just can't wait to get to heaven. He said, I've fought the good fight. He said what Paul said, 2 Timothy 4. He said, I fought the good fight. He said, I'm trying to finish this race. And I told him what I'm telling you, man, your best days are ahead of you. They're not behind you. What God has waiting on you is going to be so wonderful. And he made that possible through his son, Jesus Christ. It's a gift that we've got to accept. It's one that we've got to want and take, and I hope you'll take it tonight. Maybe you've already done that. You've already given your life to the Lord, and I hope you'll rededicate your life to him. I hope that you'll pray tonight. As you leave here, you'll be more encouraged. You'll be more committed in your walk with him, that you'll be more grateful, that you'll be willing to serve him and submit to him and do whatever he wants you to do because he loves you so much. Not out of fear, out of love, out of love. And it's out of love, Jesus said, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. It's out of love we want to do what he wants us to do, and I hope you'll do that tonight. Philip's going to lead us in this song. If I can help you in any way, I'll be here at the front. You come while we stand and sing the song of encouragement.